Welcome to Preserving a Historic Space, Nihomachi in California and the Interior West. My name is Jacqueline McDaniel and I'm the host for today's session. This session will be moderated by Sojin Kim of Los Angeles, California. On the panel will be Raymond Uno of Salt Lake City, Utah, Donna Graves, Berkeley, California, and Kara Miyagishima of Denver, Colorado. So with that said, I'd like to turn it over to your moderator today, Sojin.
Thanks, Jacqueline, and welcome everyone. Thanks for coming, and I guess we're gonna go ahead and get started. So this session is Preserving a Historic Place, Nihonmachi in California and the Interior West. And I'm Sojin Kim. I'm here basically to present this great panel that you're going to hear today and also to help facilitate any discussions or questions that follow their presentations. And I should just give you a little bit of background. This panel was conceived by museum conference organizers as an opportunity to share information from a range of regions and projects that would, again, share experiences, challenges, approaches to projects that are dealing with preserving historically Japanese American communities. And I would say that the idea for this panel was probably inspired by a lot of the work that's been going on in California with the three remaining Japantowns there in Los Angeles, San Jose, and San Francisco. And for example, in 2002, there was a state Senate bill that was passed that provided funds to these different communities for projects that help to promote the preservation of again, these three large remaining Japantowns in California. And there's a lot of really interesting things going on in these places, but the idea for this panel was to go beyond that and to take a much broader perspective on these issues of preserving these Japanese American communities. And so the idea was to look at, for example, the work that's been done in Salt Lake City that Judge Uno is going to talk about Sakura Square and its development here in Denver with Kara Miyagishima, and then to have Donna Graves from the Preserving California's Japantowns talk about not these three major Japantowns, but the many, many other pre-war Japanese American communities. So to, again, go beyond these bigger, more well-known projects to talk about a lot of other work that's being done. And I think that we're very fortunate to have these people because as a group, they have this incredible wealth of expertise and experience that they're going to share with us. And in all of their presentations, they're dealing with communities that share some things in common and then have a lot of differences. So again, we'll get a range of perspectives. But all of the places that they're going to talk about are places that have changed significantly over time. And although in many of these places, the primary residential Japanese American communities have dispersed, all of these places continue to really focus the memory and attachments of Japanese Americans. So they continue to be of social or cultural importance to Japanese Americans, or to have emotional or symbolic significance for Japanese Americans. Some of the communities that they're going to talk about date back to the pre-World War II era. Some of the communities that they're going to talk about really came out of the post-World War II resettlement era. All of the ones that are in urban areas have faced a lot of challenges around the issue of or the processes of urban renewal. So first in the late 1960s and 1970s, and then again, I think now, where you see a lot of activity happening in urban centers around the central city area, because historically Japantowns were located in these areas, again, you see a whole new series of challenges and changes that are going to be happening in these areas. And I think this is interesting because we'll, again, get different perspectives from different regions. I think as a session, the reason I'm very excited about being here is, one, just to learn about what's going on in some of these areas that I hadn't been familiar with before. But I think also they do something that's very fundamental and basic, but no less challenging, and that is that they all are trying to, they're all basically strategies. They're presenting strategies for how a community can assert its presence, its place in a community. They're all basically, they're all dealing with strategies for making visible and tangible something that actually isn't necessarily visible and tangible, and that is the ethnic history, the ethnic identity, the ethnic meaning of a place. And I think it takes on even a heightened importance when we're dealing with communities that have had a really tenuous, unstable relationship to places because of discrimination, because of forced removal during World War II, because of urban renewal. So I think this is a really exciting panel, and I'm very pleased that we have this great, distinguished group of people presenting. And I thought that the way that that we would do this. I thought first we could go geographically, go east to west, but I think that since we're in Denver, if we could start with Kara Miyagishima, since this is our host city. But let me just tell you a little bit about Kara, because she comes with a lot of knowledge and background to this. Kara, as many of you probably already know her, she's a historian with the Intermountain Region Office of the National Park Service. And she fulfilled her MA history degree at the University of Colorado in Denver with a thesis that focused on Japanese Americans in Colorado. And then at the National Park Service, Kara, as a historian, primarily is working on projects that address preservation and interpretation projects related to Japanese Americans during World War II. And I understand, correct me if I'm wrong, that you also co-authored the successful application that got Heart Mountain Concentration Camp designated as a National Historic Landmark. And you probably also, many of you may have met her because she's been involved, as well as other National Park Service historians, in this process of doing research, talking to people in communities around the country, and preparing the report that will hopefully lead to this federal preservation grant that will provide support to preserve WRA sites and other World War II confinement sites. So the other important thing you should know about Kara, though, before I invite her up here to talk to you, is she's also a native of Colorado. So she has a lot of history and roots in the area. Some of her family have been in Fort Lupton and Brighton area since the pre-World War II era, and then some of her family came to Denver during the resettlement era. So she also speaks with this experience as well.
Good morning, everyone. Thank you very much for coming to this session. I hope that you'll have an enjoyable time here at the conference. I grew up in Denver and really became interested in learning more about the history of Japanese Americans in Colorado when I started speaking more to my grandparents, and they told me more about their experiences here in Colorado, and I just thought it was so fascinating and really wanted to learn more about my own history, as I think that really makes up who you are as a person and how you relate to your community and your family. And so basically I'm going to speak mostly about the development of Sakura Square, but I also wanted to provide some brief information on when and how Japanese came to the state. Japanese Americans have played a very important and unique role in shaping the history of our state of Colorado. They first journeyed to the Intermountain region in the 1890s. They were recruited by labor contractors. Sometimes they're just motivated by adventure, or convinced by friends and relatives that had already settled here and had found success in Colorado to come to this state. I think anti-Asian sentiment on the West Coast also played a factor and prompted them to move further inland, as well as some of the labor competition in that region. The first Japanese to come to Colorado is said to be a man named Tadatsu Matsudaira, and he was a little bit, I think he was kind of rare in the sense that he wasn't a regular laborer that came to the state. He actually came from the East Coast. He first came to New Jersey and was educated at Rutgers University. Supposedly he was of noble birth in Japan, and he was a civil engineer. He first made his way to Wyoming and worked as a civil engineer for the Union Pacific. Then he moved to Golden, Colorado in 1886. He became Colorado's chief inspector of mines. He died an early age in his early 30s of tuberculosis, and he is buried at the Riverside Cemetery, which is kind of near Brighton, I guess. And there's a marker there explaining his life. Let's see if I can. So in 1890, the U.S. Census reported that there were only 10 Japanese residing in Colorado, out of which 9 lived in Denver. By 1900, there were 48 in Colorado and 20 in Denver. By 1910, Colorado's Japanese population rose to 2,300 as Japanese immigrants settled throughout the state. and primarily in Denver. There are about 585 people in Denver. Pueblo, Greeley, Sterling, Rocky Ford, and smaller communities in the South Platte and Arkansas River valleys. However, some of these, the census figures are a little bit inaccurate because I think they had difficulty in tracking a community that was very mobile and moved throughout the state based on their labor patterns. And so when I looked at one of the U.S. Immigration Commission reports, it actually documented that there were 6,000 Japanese in the state. So while Japanese came to Colorado because of the region's need for labor, I think another large reason for them coming here is that there was an anti-Chinese sentiment in Denver that culminated in the anti-Chinese riot of 1882. And so this led to a significant decline in the population that had previously provided labor in our railroad, mining, and agricultural industries. And so you also have labor contractors such as Shinsaburo Ban and Harry Naoichi Hokasano, who recruited Japanese immigrants to the state to work in the coal mines of southern Colorado, near Florence, Trinidad, and Walsenburg. They were prohibited from working in the northern coal fields and also in metal mining throughout the state. They also served as section hands on the railroads and also in the construction of dams, reservoirs, and other reclamation work. And so Hokasano is also interesting because he was an entrepreneur. He opened a restaurant in Denver. He was very active in the community and founded the state's Japanese first newspaper, Denver Shimpo. In 1908, he helped found the Denver Buddhist Temple, and he's now memorialized in the stained glass window that you see here in our state's capital. So Japanese then in Colorado, they then eventually transitioned to work in agricultural fields across the state in places like Brighton, Fort Lupton, Platteville, Fort Morgan, Sterling, in the San Luis Valley. And they did a lot of work in the sugar beet fields because the Great Western Sugar Company had a very strong presence here. So Issei, they transitioned from being wage earning laborers to entrepreneurs such as Hokusono, and the community of bachelors, as women immigrated to Colorado, they transitioned more into a settlement community as families were established, and Denver really became a central location where Issei gathered. In Denver, they found employment, they found meals, camaraderie, warm furo, they had warm bathhouses in Denver, and a place to stay. Due to racist housing codes, economic affordability, and ethnic community formation, Denver's first Japanese community sprouted around 19th and Larimer Streets and 18th through 21st Streets. And this neighborhood is really located to the, if you're staying in this hotel, it's more to the northeast side of town. It was frequently referred to as Skid Row, one of the poorest and most rundown areas of the city. By 1909, the U.S. Immigration Commission documented that there were 67 Japanese-owned or operated businesses in Denver. These ranged from boarding houses to dry goods stores, community-based newspapers such as the Colorado Times, and this other picture is taken outside of that establishment. They also established prefectural societies such as the Fukushima and Fukuoka Kenjinkai. Japanese Association of Colorado was established in 1907 to protect the interests of Japanese Americans in Colorado. And similar organizations were also established in the farming communities as well. This other picture, this is a group of people from the Japanese consulate in San Francisco. They also came to Denver to visit. There was a really strong connection with them as well. And so I thought one of the other things I thought was very interesting is that the Denver's Japanese American community, they first established a Christian church in Denver in 1908. They also had one in Pueblo. And it wasn't until 1916 that they established their first Denver Buddhist temple. And they had met previously in, you know, really informal places, such as people's houses or other business establishments. But in 1916, they found this building on 1942 Market Street, which is also near the Skid Row area. By 1920, the U.S. Census documented Colorado's population at 2,464, with 465 people living in Denver. And it's interesting, when you look at the records, they document the Denver Buddhist Temple as a separate institution. They listed 23 male boarders and 2 female boarders residing at the temple. Most were students who attended the University of Denver, and others were attending the Isle of Seminary. By 1930, Colorado's Japanese population was documented at 3,213, with 349 living in Denver. In addition to Japanese students living at the temple also boarded many Japanese who were excluded from Denver housing or who were just passing through town and needed a place to stay. One gentleman that I interviewed, he was actually part of the agricultural community in Colorado, but he said that his family would send him to the temple to live there. I think it was maybe just during the summertime. And the temple also boarded other male students. They went to Japanese school, they had kendo practice there, and from one of my interviews, I thought it was interesting, he said, you know, it was the famous M. Silks Bordello, so there were a lot of small rooms. They tore out the bottom level and used it for Buddhist services, and there was a stage and an altar at the front. There were small rooms upstairs with barely enough room for a single bed. And so in the early 1900s, it was actually a former brothel that was very, very popular. But I think it's a very interesting story, but I think at the same time, you know, people kind of felt a little uncomfortable explaining that part of the temple's past. So, although they were completely unrelated, so. He also explained that there were Japanese stores that were not near the temple, but on Larimer Street, which is really only a block away. There are ofudo, bathhouses, grocery stores, department store, clothing stores, and that there were many geared towards many of the Issei who were working in Denver on the railroads and others that had established their businesses there. So by the 1940s, the U.S. Census documents the Japanese population in Colorado as only 2,734 people. But this shifted drastically during World War II as a machi opened in southeastern Colorado, which is near Lamar. Many of you have probably been on that trip that was held on July 3rd. And so this instantly became the state's 10th largest city, with a population of over 7,500 people. That was its peak population, although more than 10,000 people passed through Amachi. So Denver's Japanese American population also increased as the war came to a close, and the WRA initiated plans to close all of the camps, and they began to implement resettlement programs and establish principal relocation offices in New York, Chicago, Seattle, places like that, Salt Lake City, but also in Denver. And this was to assist evacuees in reintroducing them back into the community, and really to prevent them from moving back to the West Coast and forming reestablishing their new honmachi, things like that. We wanted to encourage a dispersal of the community. So as the camps came to a close, the resettlement process brought an influx of former internees and their families to Denver. And this increased Denver's population very substantially to about 4,000 or 5,000 people. And the largest, of course, resettlement population was in Chicago, but I think Denver followed pretty closely behind. In 1947, a U.S. War Agency liquidation report noted that during the early war period, he wrote this, I thought it was interesting, he said, Denver was the Mecca for evacuees that were not desiring to go further eastward, as well as a stopover for those who eventually continued their journey. To many evacuees, he says, Denver became to be considered the unofficial capital of the U.S., a reputation formerly held by L.A. So this transition, this translated into a huge increase in the number of Japanese Americans owned and operated businesses. So in 1940, there were 46 businesses. By 1946, there were 258. This included barber and beauty shops, carpenters, cleaners, and laundries. There's a TK Pharmacy on 2700 Larimer Street, a Doi Pharmacy. There are fish markets, tofu-ya, such as Kojima Fish Market on 1908 Larimer Street. There's Grenada Fish and Poultry Market, Japanese sweet shops, grocery stores, and pictured on the right-hand side is Mr. Georgie Nye's Pacific Mercantile Company, which is still there today. If you go there, I think they're in a different location than they were originally, but they've been there ever since, and they're still one of the most popular Japanese grocery stores to go to, and my most favorite place as well. So after the war, evacuees, they really no longer had access to Japanese imports or West Coast businesses, and so they began to manufacture and distribute Japanese foods in Denver. The city's Japanese American businesses included tofu, shoyu, noodles, seaweed, umeboshi, and other pickle items, among other food products. And so one woman that I interviewed that was from Amachi, I thought it was interesting. She was explaining, you know, the whole process of how they made the nori and the seaweed and umeboshi, things like that. I thought it was pretty, it was just really fascinating that that happened, you know, a few blocks from where we are today. There are also apartments and hotels run by Japanese Americans, including the Miyako Hotel, Airedale Hotel on 20th Street, which is now on the National Register. There are employment agencies, restaurants, although it's kind of interesting, some of the names of the restaurants are Manchu Grill, Chop Suey, but they weren't necessarily serving Chinese American food, but Japanese American food. And these businesses were recorded in several different community directories, such as this one published in 1946 by Hanasono Photo Studios. And I thought it was also neat that many of the business advertisements read that their business was located in the heart of Nihonjin Town. So I thought that was really interesting. And I know just listening to my grandfather, you know, speak about the different places that he worked at, I thought it was really interesting. He said, you know, he worked for the Dinargo Produce Market, the Grenada Fish Market, and then he eventually managed and operated the Cathay Post, which is now called the Nisei Post Building. It served Chinese American food, but he managed and operated that for a few years. And so this community in Denver, I think, was really a thriving community, but it gradually changed over time as families, you know, moved back to the West Coast, or maybe they decided to move back east. And also as the housing and employment opportunities opened up for Nisei. And so by the 1950s and 60s, there was still a significant presence of Japanese Americans in Denver. And the businesses were pretty much centralized in the same area. Japanese Americans lived in nearby neighborhoods such as Curtis Park in the 1960s, and they also lived alongside Latino African American communities or families as well. But you know, over time, they spread out to live across the greater Denver metro area, especially as you know, the racist housing covenants and things like that changed over time, although very gradually. There are other changes taking place in Denver and across the nation. In 1958, the city established the Denver Urban Renewal Authority to confront housing problems and restore economic growth and the city's luster. So DURA was given the power to condemn, purchase, and level private property for redevelopment. Under DURA's directive, several of the city's slums were slated for redevelopment. In 1967, DURA tackled Denver Skid Row, which included J-Town, through the Skyline Urban Renewal Project. And so this project focused on, they proposed to demolish 30 rundown city blocks funded by a $33 million grant from the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development. And so included in these 30 blocks were pawn shops and, you know, other seedy establishments, a lot of liquor stores, bars. But there are also the Japanese American owned and run businesses in the same area where Denver's Japantown began in the early 1900s. And so in the picture in the middle on the right hand side, there's the Akebono restaurant. And then on the bottom is TK Pharmacy, where my grandmother also worked after the war. And so as the city began to transform this area into an economically viable city center, and Denver Skid Row became valuable real estate for the city's redevelopment plans, many of the remaining Japanese American owned or run businesses relocated or closed down. However, several years prior to Denver's urban renewal movement, the Tri-State Buddhist Temple, which is now located at 1947 Lawrence Street, they were, you know, had plans to build an apartment complex that would provide low-income housing for the elderly Issei. In 1962, they chartered the Tri-State Buddhist Church Apartments. In search of housing, they bid unsuccessfully on two Dura projects before Dura began the Skyline project. Under the Skyline project, Dura then approached the temple and gave them the option of relocating or purchasing and rebuilding the entire block with government assistance. So the temple really turned this dilemma into an opportunity to build a housing complex and commercial spaces for Japanese American businesses that had to relocate due to the Skyline project. And they purchased the land from Dura in 1971. So I think at the same time, I ran across some information that said that, you know, the decision was not without controversy, because there were some businesses that were interested in leasing space from Sakura Square, but they were not able to afford the higher leasing rates. And so over time, because they could not afford these prices, they were left with few alternatives but to either close down or move. In 1971, Bertram A. Bruton and Associates, a Denver-based architectural firm that was founded in 1961 by Bruton, who is a renowned African-American architect. His more recent works have included work on the DIA terminal. He worked in conjunction with contractors to construct a 20-story tower made of concrete and a clean modern design for subsidized housing in a shopping complex, which is now Sakura Square, and the apartment complex, which is called Tamai Tower. In addition to the complex, local nurseries and gardening associations, they also landscaped the area. They installed a Japanese garden in the middle of the courtyard. And so here in this picture, you're looking down from the penthouse of Tamai Tower, looking down into the courtyard area. And at the same time, Bruton and Associates, they also renovated the exterior of the Denver Buddhist Temple to blend in with the style and the architecture of the Sakura, or the Tamai Tower and Sakura Square complex. And I thought it was interesting, the planning committee turned down Bertram's suggestions to decorate the temple with oriental carvings and to make it look, you know, more interesting architecturally, because they preferred to spend the money on air conditioning and carpet, which they thought was a higher priority for them. So I thought that was interesting. And if you walk by it, sometimes you may not even really notice that it is, you know, a temple based on its design. But so then in the Sakura Square courtyard, there are also erected three different statues representing important figures within Colorado history. One is Minoru Yasui, or Min Yasui, who many of you know mainly for his noteworthy landmark Supreme Court case, but he was also a civil rights lawyer in Denver and advocate for Japanese Americans here, a community leader within the Japanese American Citizens League. There's also a statue for Governor Ralph Carr, who publicly welcomed Japanese American evacuees to Colorado during the war, despite anti-Japanese sentiment and political opposition, and you'll hear more about the story later on, I think today, during your luncheon with Adam Schrager, who wrote about Ralph Carr's life. There's also a statue of Reverend Yoshitaka Tamai, who devoted 53 years of his life as a Buddhist minister, and for whom the 20-story Tamai Tower apartment complex is named. And he's the one, he came in during the 1930s, during the Depression, when the temple was located on Market Street and really in disrepair and need of, you know, I think the city was going to condemn it and wanted to close it down. And he basically worked for free for many, many years and gave his salary and put it towards the preservation of the building. And he is known to many as the Living Buddha, just as how he carried his life. Today, Sakura Square in the past has included a variety of different businesses, both, you know, Japanese American and not. So they had like Ichiban Electric, Akebono Restaurant. Recently, they had the Museum of Contemporary Art, which has moved their our dental offices. Some of these things have changed over time. I know that now there are some other doctor's offices, things like that in there. There was the Rocky Mountain Jiho that has closed down. But of course, the Pacific Mercantile is still a very successful business. There's the temple. There are a few other Japanese restaurants and things like that there. What has also changed over time is the makeup of the residents that are at Tamai Tower. Originally, it was built for the elderly Issei community, and now it has really changed. I had lived there for a small period of time as well, and now it really is very diverse. There are Japanese, Chinese, Thai, Latino, African American, and Caucasian residents there. There are people that are elderly, like in their 90s. There are people who are younger in their 20s and attend the university, nearby university on Auraria campus. So Denver's Nihonmachi has really changed drastically over the years, but it still remains a central place for Denver's Japanese American community in Colorado. In Denver's downtown area, Sakura Square exists as a central location where Japanese Americans who are further integrated into mainstream American society reconnect with family, friends, and the larger Japanese American community around a shared culture. Every weekend, Sakura Square, the heart of Denver's old Japantown, is still bustling with activity each Sunday. As Buddhist services commence, children attend their weekly session or lessons of Japanese language, judo, minyo dancing, taiko drumming, and as others stock up on their weekly grocery supplies or drop by to eat at the Yoko's restaurant or gather for community meeting or visit their relatives and friends who still live at Tamai Tower. And so I think today that Sakura Square is much more than just a physical structure. It really symbolizes the preservation of an ethnic community as well as their spirit, history, and culture over time. I think it is best explained by a plaque which is located outside of Tamai Tower in the courtyard, which reads that this place is dedicated in commemoration of the men and women of Japanese ancestry who brought Oriental culture to the Rocky Mountain region and to those who continue to sustain this cherished heritage. So I think, in a sense, if the temple had not purchased this block during the urban redevelopment period in the 60s, that there was a great possibility that that would have been destroyed and that there would not be any sign of Japanese American history in the area today. And so I have included pictures here of my favorite time of year, which is our annual Cherry Blossom Festival, which is combined, you know, non-traditionally with the Obon. And I think it's just a very significant time for Japanese Americans in Colorado, and it has grown to have meaning for other people within Colorado as well, especially those who are interested in learning more about Japanese American history and culture, things like that. And so what was once considered a dicey part of town, today Denverites now flock to a city's old Skid Row, which is now bordered by the trendy lower downtown, now we call it Lodo, and the new ballpark historic district, which surrounds Coors Field and is home of the Rockies, which I don't know if anyone went to the game last night, but I think we did okay. And so I think it's really interesting just looking at the photographs from the past and, you know, documents that are, you know, describe Skid Row as such this, you know, such an awful place to go. There's, you know, all these pawn shops, liquor stores, and, you know, at the same time, there was this Japanese American community really thriving in that area. And now that it's transitioning to be, you know, Denver's ballpark historic district, you know, they're advertising $1 million lofts. You know, as it says, it's a uniquely mixed with warehouse, light industry, retail, and residential space, one of the fastest growing residential areas in Denver. And if you have more than $1 million, you're welcome to move on in. I just have a few other things to add also is that, you know, there's Sakura Square, but there are also a few other places nearby that speak to the Japanese Americans past in Colorado. So up the street from Coors Field is another landmark for Japanese Coloradans, and that's the Nisei Post, number 185. I think many Nikkei still refer to it today as the Cathay Post. And it, until very recently, also housed Mori's Japanese restaurant. But I think in the past month, that has closed down. So I don't know what plans are for the future of that building. But I know it had a lot of, it has a lot of significance for many Japanese here, and also for my family as well. My father always talked about, you know, the different community gatherings that they would hold there. They'd have holiday parties in the room upstairs, and one of the community members would dress up as Santa Claus, and he remembers going there to help my grandfather after he, you know, returned from judo practice. He helped my grandfather, you know, with the place settings, things like that. And I remember just recently we went to eat there a few months ago, and they still have their original black doors with the, there's like a Chinese symbol on each of the doors. I don't know what it says, but that go back to the kitchen area. And I know my dad would ask about that because they had renovated the inside of the restaurant. He asked, you know, like, are you guys going to keep those, or, you know, are you going to get rid of those? And they just looked at him like, I don't know what you're talking about. But and so another very interesting place is around the corner from the Nisei Post, 1942 Market Street, the first Denver Buddhist Temple. The building is still there, and now, of course, it is used. It's a restaurant. I think it's called Maddie's House of Mirrors or something like that. And it's a really trendy, you know, hotspot for club goers and people who want to have a nice dinner. I think the interesting piece, though, is even though they really try to draw people in, playing up the history of this building as a former bordello, they also do recognize the significance of this place, you know, as part of Japanese American history in Colorado. And in the entrance of the building, they have some photographs that were taken from the Japanese American community during that time, and explain that history a little bit further. And I think the last time I spoke with the manager at that time was George Mannion. He said that every year there's still a group of Japanese Americans who reunite for lunch at Maddie's every year to share memories of living in the old temple, you know, where students sported, couples married, and children played. I think it was also a place where when my grandfather's father passed away, you know, his funeral was held there too. So it's still a very significant place, although it's kind of interesting on the plaque here. It says that the building was a Buddhist temple and warehouse from 1920 until 1998. So it doesn't really say too much about that piece of history. Another place that you may run into when you're walking around in that area is the 20th Street Cafe, which is up the block from the Airedale building. And this was also established after the war during the resettlement community. And if you're interested in having either a hamburger or fried rice or a teriyaki beef bowl, I think they still serve those. But it's really a neat place. I think it holds a lot of memories for people within the community as a place that they would frequent when that community during the resettlement period and after. And so I think there are many tangible remnants of Japanese American history in Colorado today. And I think it's, it is, you know, Sakura Square is kind of like a centralized place for that history, but our history is also memorialized and commemorated in other places throughout the state and throughout the city. So you have, you know, in the U.S. Capitol, there's the stained glass window of Hokosano. I think there's also a plaque dedicated there to Ralph Carr. Most recently, there was legislation passed to rename part of a highway, 285 near Kenosha Pass, in honor of Ralph Carr. There is a new building. The plan is, that I recently read at least, is that the new Colorado Historical Society building will also be named after Ralph Carr. There's a Minyasui Plaza building downtown that is named in his honor. He actually worked for that building, or worked in that building as director of what is now the Denver Agency for Human Rights and Community Relations. I think that You know, there are also other efforts, ongoing efforts right now to preserve not only the, you know, whatever remaining sites there are, but also to focus on preserving, you know, photographs and oral histories and memories of, you know, that time within the community and of Sakura Square. And so I, there are some community members that are currently working on developing a cultural center. It's a Japanese American Resource Center of Colorado. Carolyn Takeshita has been a huge part of getting that started, and they recently found space within Sakura Square for their center. But their focus, I think, is less on preserving the collections and more on really preserving the memory of that space. And so the history of Japanese Americans in Colorado, I think, is immensely rich and vital, to our understanding of our community and our society. So preserving the physical sites or buildings related to the history of Japanese American experience, I think it really enriches one's sense of pride and identity as one is able to walk the same paths that your ancestors walked, to visit the buildings that your families once frequented many years ago. It's a very rich experience, I think. And by preserving and sharing the legacy of Japanese American history in Colorado, these important stories in American history will continue to provide inspiration and hope for future generations. And I think it is very vital linked to our past. So thank you very much for your time. Thanks.
Super interesting, and I hope that some of you will get some chance. I know that the conference is so full of activities, but I do hope that some of you will get a chance to walk over to Sakura Square and look at some of the things that she's just been describing. We're going to shift regions, and go to Utah. And we have Judge Raymond S. Uno to talk to us today about activities going on in Salt Lake City. But let me tell you a little bit about Judge Uno. He's a retired senior third district court judge of the state of Utah. And when I first talked to him on the phone, he kept saying, I am an amateur, I'm not an expert, I'm just doing this by default. But what you have to understand is he has some 50 years experience of very impressive work, not just in social services and law, but also in community advocacy and preservation. He has too many awards for me to even name. You know, just Google him and you'll see that already in 2008 he's been, you know, honored by several different organizations for all of the service that he's done for the community. But he's also a native of Utah, born in Ogden, Utah. He actually then grew up largely in El Monte, California, in Southern California, before he and his family were removed from the West Coast and incarcerated at Heart Mountain concentration camp. After camp, and then after also serving in the MIS, he returned to his home state of Utah, where he attended the University of Utah and got his master's in social work and also his law degree. So he's worked as a social worker, he's worked as an attorney, he's worked as a judge sometime in his, you know, in his spare time somewhere. He also found time to be the national president of the JACL. He's chaired the Utah State Advisory Committee for the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights. And currently, and probably for the foreseeable future, I'm guessing, he also is president of the Japanese Community Preservation Committee Incorporated of Salt Lake City. And so we are very fortunate to have him here to talk about the really extensive work that they have been doing over in Salt Lake City.
Let's see, I'm told I have 15 minutes, and as a judge,
as a judge,
I have to keep time because I tell the attorneys, you got 10 minutes and that's all you have, and then you're cut off, so you can cut me off at 10 minutes or whatever you want. I'm talking about Utah Japantown, a brief summary of Salt Lake City, Utah Japantown preservation and possible restoration efforts. The Japanese American Centennial Committee of 1995 is a three-day celebration culminating with the publication of Japanese Americans in Utah. And this is a book that we published, and this came about because I mentioned that, you know, we're having a centennial, we should do something. And so I called a committee together, and I found out that every time you open your mouth, you end up being the chair. So we had a three-day event, which turned out very successful. And this book I'll try to pass around, and you can look at it, but it tells the whole history of the Japanese in Utah up to 1995. And this was This was, can you pass that around? This was a project that culminated in the 3 days, and we had a banquet at the end of the third day, and our, let's see, I'm trying to think who are, we had a number of keynote speakers, but the ambassador of Japan also came, so we were kind of privileged to have a number of notable people. But there are about 900 people who attended the banquet, and that booklet there, we thought we were going to go into a hole because it cost thousands and thousands of dollars. But as it turned out to be a gold mine, and I think we have over $20,000 left in the bank, so we have a little money to spend on other things. And then some people got left out of that, so they started complaining, so we had to add an addendum a couple years later. And now they're saying that we should bring it up to date so that everybody that's, you know, in the past could be recognized. A Day of Remembrance, Ogden, Japantown. In February of 2007, I've mentioned again, you know, I'm a Ogden boy, and so we should kind of have some reunion, like, and as I mentioned, that they said, well, you chair it, but I got somebody else to chair it. I told them, don't worry about it, we'll get everything all set. So we got it set. And this is also a 3-day thing. And a lot of the exhibits that you see downstairs on Ogden was a result of this 3-day affair. And we also had a banquet, and our keynote speaker happened to be Irene Hirano. She was kind enough to come over and talk to us. Recent chronology of Japantown activities for Salt Lake, 9/29/04. In 1967, when Denver was doing some of its renovation and making some big changes in the city, they tore down Japantown completely. I mean, right on the very top of Japantown, they built the convention center, just like just right across the street, the Colorado Conventions. They built a great big project right there. And the reason they built that, they told us, is that the National Outdoor Retail Association summer and winter shows bring in $40 million a year. And so we weren't worth $40 million, so they just built the Salt Palace and expanded it in order to accommodate the expansion. And we had a series of meetings because we didn't want them to just forget about us. The only remnants of the Japanese community then was the Japanese Church of Christ and the Buddhist Church, which I'll show you later on. And they were going to build, they were going to block off the street so that the Buddhist temple, which has its opponent in front of the street, would no longer have the ability to do that. So we opposed that, and they had weekly meetings, and we wanted to be involved in that. And, you know, being a judge, I thought, well, you know, we ought to probably assemble a bunch of attorneys and, you know, protest that, because we knew that they had a timeline in order to build that. And they knew that if we filed an injunction, that would stall that, and that timeline would not be met. So they were very accommodating. So we had a chance to meet with the Planning Commission, and we made our opening statement about how we were kind of evacuation, we were thrown out. Now with the Japantown being destroyed, we had no place to go except the two churches. And so they're very, everybody was very, very sympathetic. We got support letters from candidates for the county mayor. At that time, it was the election. And so we went up to them and said, sign this. And they didn't know what they were signing. They signed it. So that helped us. As a result of that, the Japanese Community Preservation Committee was incorporated. And again, I got involved in this, and I just happened to be a little older and a little, had some history. And so again, I got elected the president, and I told him I don't want to have anything to do with it, except I'll be advisor. No, they made me do that. So that consisted of the Salt Lake Buddhist Temple, Japanese Church of Christ, three Utah JSL chapters, and the community at large. And our primary function was to negotiate with Salt Palace Convention Center, and the which was the expansion committee, and the city and the county. This little booklet is a publication that comes out. It's kind of nice, high-class, glossy booklet. And they came up to me about a couple of months ago and said, what's happened to Japantown? And I said, well, we're trying to do a few things, but we're kind of in limbo right now. I said, well, I want to write an article about it. So here's a picture of our committee. Not everybody was there, but it came out nice and glossy. At least we have a nice, good picture in a magazine to represent the Japanese community in this particular project. And this is the article that was written in that magazine, and it shows a little diagram of where Japantown is. And, you know, we proposed to do something about it. The summary of events from January 05 to January 06. We acted positively to threat of negative impact because of expansion of the South Palace Convention Center, got positive media attention, TV, radio, newspaper. We got quite a bit of, you know, real good publicity for some reason. And that's primarily, I guess, because they just completely destroyed Japantown, nothing there, and everybody said, gee, did that really happen? They didn't do anything for you? But we tried to do something, like Sakura Square. We're trying to get a big block, but, you know, the people in business were too old, and the younger people were not interested, so that kind of fell through, and there's only one thing that remains, which I'll show you. But we attended all the meetings of the Planning Commission, which took a lot of time. You know, every week we're going to meetings. And then we went to meetings with all the different other organizations and government agencies that was involved in this. And then we were able to get the combined city and county councils to meet to hear our grievances. And they were very sympathetic. So as a result of that, we got representation on the South Palace Convention Center Planning Commission. And then we met with the key chairperson of the legislature, and they have to tax the hotels in order to pay for some of the expansion. And one of our members got the idea that, you know, if they're going to tax those people, we ought to try to get some money out of that tax. And so we went up there, and this is a miracle kind of a thing. We got to meet with the chairperson of the committee, and we got a person to write an amendment to that legislation. And he says, well, I'll be glad to kind of get this in there. And then he got it passed. So there's a provision in there, which we'll probably never realize. But if we get enough tax revenue, that we could use part of that for, you know, rebuilding Japantown. Then we testified before the key Senate committee on taxation, and our group is a very small group of about five people, but it looks like, you know, we do actually represent the whole community, but it looks like it's a big group. And, you know, we all went over there and we all testified. And then we got a joint city and county resolution supporting the restoration of Japantown. We went to the city council, the county council, we talked with the mayors, and we talked with the council members, and, you know, we encouraged them that, you know, they should, you know, help us do something, because you guys really killed the Japanese community. And so they had this real guilt feeling of trying to do something. In fact, the whole community kind of felt guilty by the time we got finished. And they essentially passed the resolution. It says joint city and county resolution supporting restoration in Japantown was passed. And let's see. We got favorable support from the governor, met with key representatives of the city and county on pursuing Japantown project. In other words, we met with all the different agencies and their heads, and tell them, you know, they would tell us what they could do, and we asked them if they could do these things. And, you know, we got support from a lot of different groups, which didn't really materialize at this point yet. And hopefully in the future, maybe we might be able to do something. Where to from here? We had a choice: restore Japantown, restore parts of Japantown, rename First South Japantown Street, you know, other different alternatives. And we decided we'll continue Japantown, even though it's really a difficult project to build Japantown when there's no Japantown there except the two churches. I sent a letter to the Consul General, and he didn't respond. There was a person in one of the government agencies that says there's appropriation available in Congress, so we had him prepare it, send it in. I don't know whatever happened to that. But one of the good things that came out was the National Urban Land Institute, consisting of property owners, investors, advisors, developers, architects, lawyers, lenders, planners, regulators, contractors, engineers, university professors, librarians, students, and interns, expressed the interest in our Japantown project because we had gotten a lot of publicity. Then we made an application. Our proposal for Japantown was selected by the Urban Land Institute Private and Public and Private Partnership Council project analysis for May 11, 2006. So they were right at the Salt Palace, so it was very easy for them to see Japantown. And they prepared a lot of diagrams, and we got a lot of suggestions, and they made recommendations, and it ended up that we form a small, intimate, pedestrian accessible mall with Japanese hotel, Japanese garden, open market, signage, and financing through the RDA, hotel chain donors, and sponsors. After a series of meetings with the Salt Palace Convention Committee, and you know, this is dragged out over 2 or 3 years from 1904, and so we had to just constantly tell them, no, we want this and we want that, and they'd always say, oh, no, we don't have any money, we can't do that. And so we had to kind of bicker with them, but they kind of, I think, gave us most of the things that we wanted and didn't do a lot of things that they were going to do. There are major modifications on expansion plans, height, location, and amenities, buffer zone lined with trees and plants between JCC and SPCC. Loading dock walls have, and I'll show you all these things here, so I won't mention that, but this is the map of city of Salt Lake City. And so let me show. This is the Salt Lake Japanese Church, Christian Church, and this is the Buddhist Church, and this is First South that I'll make reference to. And all around is redevelopment, and the dark green area, and like crosses right there, that's the Mormon Church, and I don't know how many are LDS or how many are familiar with the Mormons, but 70% of Utah is Mormon, so you know who makes all the decisions in Utah. And they are building this, what they call a City Creek project. It's a $1 billion project, and they're just kind of, you know, making a huge, huge new city right there. And on the left side over there, left of yours, is a gateway, which is the new project, which is a huge project. And all around Japantown, or proposed Japantown, or developments. And they haven't touched the Japantown, I guess because everybody's a little bit afraid of our reaction. So that they have a vacant piece of land there that we don't know what to do with, but we don't have the money to do anything with. And so this is what Japantown used to look like. And then going up where all those prints are of the names of the stores and things like that used to be Japantown. And right in the middle of that, they built the Salt Palace. And so it gets completely obliterated in Japantown. The only things that were left, as I mentioned, is the Buddhist church and the Christian church. And let's see, let me skip that one. This is the Christian church. This is one on the end over that I was telling you about. And the Struve building there is up for sale for $2 million. The guy jacked the price up because he knew that, you know, if we wanted it, we'd have to pay that price. So we're still kind of negotiating. And that shows a Japanese Christian church, and in the back is the education building. And I mentioned that they have helped us put a buffer zone, and the buffer zone is right where the parking and the driveway is, and they built put plants and things in there. And on the right is the Japanese garden, and they put this Japanese garden in for us as an amenity for us. And this is the front view of the Japanese garden, and on the left, I show you, there's the signage right there, and it says Nihon Machi, and then it's in Japanese, dedicated to the Issei and Nisei pioneers. And then this is the parking lot that they agreed to let us park in when we have our festivals and things like that, 400 car parking lot. And then on the right you see the gate. Those are supposed to be kimono designs so that it reflects the Japanese community. And then on the right, you see the wall there. It has Japanese tile walls. And there's a car there. And on top of the car, you see there's a Japanese lamp. And that kind of goes along the whole street there. And this is the rest of the wall there. And the thing about this is the back end of the loading dock of the convention center. So anytime they have anything, the semis are parked in front of the Christian church and the Buddhist church. When they have rodeos, we have manure and you know, all over. It used to really be bad. So you know, everybody was complaining that you know, we're on the rear end of the Salt Palace and nobody sees us, but everybody sees only the beautiful front side of the Salt Palace, and we're the ones that suffer the most. So we really complained a lot. And you see the kimono design on the wall. They built that on both sides of the wall there and on the gates. This here is the driveway, and the driveway there was supposed to not be there because initially they said, you know, it costs too much to build under. It costs twice as much, and so we don't want to spend the money. So I went to the county commission, and I told them, hey, you know, you're going to kill the Japanese community that's left. And I said, you know, that's the last nail in our coffin of the Japanese community. And reporter who was reporting her on that wanted to put that into the article, and the publisher opposed it, but somehow that got in there, and one of the radio announcers said, you know, do you mind if I use that term, last nail in the coffin of the Japanese community? I says, go ahead. So anyway, they built under it, cost them twice as much, but you know, the community is not choked off. This is the back end of the, this in here was the back end of the South Palace going east. And this here is the Buddhist temple, and behind that is the high rise. That's the only thing that's existing that we kind of wanted to have of the Japanese community. We had to have a residential business and so forth on this street here. But the Buddhist temple and the Japanese Church of Christ are the only things that are left. And you'll see July 12th, next week, we're going to have a festival, and it will be on that street, and we'll have the whole street to use. And this again is the picture of the high rise and the parking lot. That parking lot and the building, the building right behind that parking lot next to the high rise is the building that we have to buy if we want that property. The same person owns that building, owns the parking lot. He wants $30 million. And when we started out, it was $12 million. And then as the days went by, it went higher. Now it's $30 million. And that again is the view of the parking lot there. And this is a view looking west from where the Buddhist temple is at, and tells you, it shows you the gateway project that's on the very end. And this here, let's see, this is the Energy Solutions, and this is the place where the Utah Jazz plays. And so you can see that there's a lot of traffic in this whole area that's being developed. And, you know, if we can get enough money, that would be a gold mine for us, because we could build a nice Japanese community there and have businesses and religious services and everything. This, again, is the Energy Solutions. And then you see there's on the right, there's a sign. That sign says Japantown Street. And then if you look where those signals are, that says Japantown Street. And it's the same on the other side. And again, Japantown Street on First South, the sign that we got. And then we're coming back to the beginning. And then, and let's see, January 2007 to present, we had open house for the honorary Japantown Street, name change, signed document supporting it. We had to have an open house, because if anybody opposed that name to Japantown, they can go in there and give their reasons why they oppose it. Fortunately, no one came to oppose it. But, you know, a lot of times when you have this kind of thing, the people that, you know, don't like Japanese or have some opposition to having a name named after an ethnic group oppose it, but fortunately no one came. So all of us that wanted it, favored it, went in there and we signed it. So the only ones that signed it were those that were in favor of it. And then April 2007, we had a third annual Nihon Matsuri, a Japanese garden dedicated in honor of the Issei and Nisei pioneers. And I mentioned to you that the signage was there. And the signage, we had a dispute with the South Palace. Who's going to pay for that? You know, a couple thousand dollars. And they said, well, you guys pay for it. And I said, why should we pay for it? We're not the ones that caused all this trouble. And we bickered back and forth. And finally, they said, okay, we'll do it. You know, if you are complaining enough, they always find money to do the things that have to be done. We're, you know, continue to seek developers and financiers. And all the other places are really expanding and developing and growing, and you know, we'd like to be part of that. And Third West is a part of what they want to make the ethnic corridor. The Greeks are on one side, the Italians on the other, and then we come on the other end. And if they think that if we can do that, we could really make that ethnic corridor. At the present time, Janie Iwamoto, who is the vice president, has been appointed to the South Palace Convention Center Facilities Committee, which means every decision that's made in the South Palace, she's there and she's part of the making of the decision. So, you know, we got that done. And the other thing is, you know, because of the publicity we got from this, one of the commissioners asked Janie to run for a county council. Now, so now she's a candidate for the county council, And for District 4, she will be the first Asian American to run for public office in the state of Utah. And unfortunately, I'm trying to be her campaign manager, and it's a tough job, I found out, to be a campaign manager. And so at this time, we're just still looking for developers and financiers. Thank you.
Thank you, Raymond. That was really actually very fascinating. And I, you know, I'm sorry because we're going a little bit late, but I really wanted to let people be able to speak because I think these projects are really interesting and extraordinary, and this is a great opportunity to be able to hear people talk about them. So we're going into our last presentation. There may not be a lot of time for questions, but now you see who these people are, and I hope you can catch up to them and speak with them. The last presenter we have is Donna Graves, who is a historian, writer, cultural and public arts planner based in Berkeley. And she has what I think is a really great disciplinary combination. She has a master's degree in urban planning and another master's degree in American civilization. And I think this is really important to how it informs the really great work that she's been doing in California for the past 20 years. I first became aware of her work when she was executive director of the Power of Place Project in Los Angeles, which was a project that was really trying to document and preserve multi-ethnic histories in the downtown areas of Los Angeles. And there was a really great project that was actually done in Little Tokyo, right adjacent to where the Japanese American National Museum is. She has worked on really too many projects for me to mention, but they include the City of Richmond's Rosie the Riveter Memorial, where she oversaw the development of the first monument to women's contributions to the home front during the war. And she's also co-author of the book Cento at 6th and Main, Preserving Landmarks of Japanese American Heritage, which is about Seattle. She's currently project director for Preserving California's Japantowns, and this is a statewide effort that's documenting over 40 pre-war Nikkei communities in the state. So thanks, Donna, for taking the tail end of this panel.
You guys need to stand up and stretch. No, you're awake? Good. So let's see if I can find it. I might need your help.
I'm sorry about that.
Well, my colleague Jill Shiraki, I'll point out before I start, she's in back there. We are the Preserving California's Japantowns team. And we're honored to have the opportunity to share this project with you. It's the first statewide effort to identify, research, and document historic resources located in Japantowns throughout California. Our project is sponsored by the California Japanese American Community Leadership Council, and we have had generous funding through the California Civil Liberties Public Education Program over the last 3 years. This project grew out of the energies that Sojin alluded to when community forces rallied around California Senate Bill 307, which focused on protecting the cultural heritage of the well-known Japantowns, San Francisco, San Jose, and Los Angeles. One of the ways that the California Japanese American Leadership Council, which helped spearhead that effort, convinced the California legislature to pass Senate Bill 307 was their reasoning that of the dozens of Japantowns, or Nihonmachi, that were scattered throughout California before World War II, only these three still had portions that were vitally intact, and that preserving them, planning for this preservation, was critical. The work that's been conducted in those three communities under SB 307 reflects a growing understanding that historic resources in Japanese American communities are crucial not only to California, but to the United States as a whole, which I think we've seen beautifully in these other presentations this morning. Yet it's also clear that economic pressure and demographic shifts threaten the historic structures, businesses, and organizations that made up these places. SB 307 helped raise awareness, both within and outside the Nikkei community, that these tangible legacies of the past can only be transmitted to future generations if they're identified, protected, and cared for. As the 1940 map on the right shows, California held the largest population of Nikkei in the United States just prior to World War II. And Japanese Americans resided in nearly every region of the state, yet their historical presence is often invisible. World War II incarceration wreaked havoc on the physical and social fabric of communities as well as on individual lives. Few Nihonmachi were able to regain their vitality during resettlement. So our project started with four goals. One was to reclaim the stories of buildings and landscapes that made up California's Japantowns. Thank you. including the dozens that disappeared after World War II. Our fundamental task has been to identify extant resources associated with pre-war Japan towns, mostly because very few communities have had the resource or knowledge to do these kinds of surveys to document historic resources. One of the most powerful arguments for undertaking this work is that these are the last years during which we can gather memories from Nisei, the people who grew up in these communities. And finally, we have found, as we had hoped, that the research we're producing is raising awareness and providing the basis for efforts to designate, protect, and interpret historical structures and landmarks throughout the state. Defining what makes a Japantown and selecting which communities we were going to study was one of our first steps. We conducted baseline research on over 70 Japantowns across the state, and from that research selected a list of about 45 in consultation with a committee of expert advisors. The list was based on the size of the community. We had a population threshold of 100 or greater, geographic distribution across the state, the presence of a critical mass of community institutions, and range of commercial activities, whether they were urban or rural. Now, there were so many Nihonmachi in California that many people have come up to Jill and I and said, now, why did you pick Florin and not Elk Grove? Or why did you pick Fowler and not Visalia? And sometimes it had to do with that we knew that there were historic resources in those places that could be a catalyst for some kind of reclaiming of public memory. But we've also tried to support people who wanted to document those additional Japantowns. And in fact, Henry Isakari has conducted his own survey of French Camp and turned up some very interesting information. It's tying the stories and personal memories, the lived experience of California's Nikkei, to buildings and landscapes across our state that's really the ultimate aim of preserving California's Japantowns. Our first step toward reclaiming this history has been reconnaissance-level surveys of these 45 communities. And one of our primary sources, in addition to Nisei, were the detailed listings that were included in publications by the Nikkei newspapers before the war. While we expected to find some traces of these thriving Japantowns that suffered such violent disruption by World War II incarceration, Jill and I are happy to share with you that the results of our historic surveys have actually been hundreds and hundreds of sites and buildings, and far more extensive than we'd hoped. I'll only be able to touch on a little bit of that today because our time is short, but we have a very extensive website that we'll direct you to at the end. We found things that surprised us, such as the dispersed pattern of many Japanese-American communities before the war. While some, like Marysville, which you can see represented in the map on the left developed by cartographer Ben Pease, fit the traditional ideas of a concentrated ethnic enclave, several others were more like Oakland, which you see on the right. Oakland had Nikkei businesses, organizations, and industries scattered over 10 miles of the cityscape. We also found places that confirmed our fears about this history being erased from public view. In addition to factors that both Kara and Mr. Uno alluded to, post-war factors like access to suburban housing and urban renewal in places like Sacramento and Stockton that pretty much finished off Japantowns that had revived after the war. There were other cases like Santa Barbara, which I find especially ironic. The heart of Santa Barbara's Nihonmachi was demolished in the 1960s to make way for a new state park that recreated the 17th century Presidio, which had been on that site. And all that's left of Vacaville's Nihonmachi, one of the largest and first Nikkei communities in California, is a section of the historic cemetery with markers for the Issei and Nisei who passed on, and a marker at the former site of the Buddhist church, which was recently made a California point of historical interest. And we found that many of the places we visited face imminent threats. I'm just showing you four examples of sites that are threatened, or in the case of the San Pablo Florist in Berkeley, a Nikkei-run florist shop for over 70 years from the 1930s up to the late 1990s, which was just demolished a few months ago. This really has to do with lack of awareness of the historical significance of these buildings and development pressures that often threatened them. But the good news is that our statewide survey has identified so many places that are associated with Japanese American businesses, cultural institutions, and social organizations across California, and that can be places where this history can be remembered and interpreted and connected to issues today. However, we found that there's often very little awareness of the connection between these sites and their Nikkei heritage. The vast majority of structures that we identified could best be described as modest. They generally don't announce their historic significance through their physical form. This is working class immigrant history that has, for the most part, kind of been under the radar of traditional landmarks programs and heritage organizations. On the upper right is a typical example of our findings. The picture is of Jill and I with Mas Hashimoto in Watsonville. We're standing in front of his childhood home on Union Street, which had previously served as the headquarters for the local Japanese Association in the 1920s. You can see it depicted on the upper left. When the Japanese Association moved into new quarters, Mas's father bought the building, moved it down the street, and added a floor, allowing his family to live on the bottom level while renting out the top floor as offices to a Dr. Ito. The Hashimotos ran a small udon shop and sake brewery out of the building in the 20s and 30s until Mas's father died and his mother and siblings began working in local vegetable fields to keep the family going. Jill and I were thrilled to find the photo at the bottom, this panorama of the Watsonville Buddhist Church proudly celebrating their 20th anniversary in 1926. This is in the collection of the Japanese American National Museum. And you can see just to the left of the church is the Hashimoto's home when it was the Japanese Association building. This structure, of course, doesn't appear on any historic inventories other than ours. It isn't a local landmark. And without the kind of research that we're all doing, this kind of building could easily be lost because the stories that it has to tell are not connected to it. One of the most interesting aspects of the surveys we've been doing is the window they open on historic and current relationships between Nihonmachi and other communities. This is a more complex topic than I can cover here, but the long-time relationship between Japantowns and Chinatowns was apparent in many of the places we surveyed. A more surprising finding was the vital connection to California's current Latino population. Historic Japantowns are often the place where immigrants from Mexico and Central America have also found a toehold in the United States. We identified numerous structures that once held a Japanese store or church, now house Latino groups and businesses. Given the working class immigrant nature of pre-World War II Japantowns and California's large population of recent immigrants, maybe this isn't surprising, but we thought it was worth noting and contemplating as a potential base for developing interpretive strategies and programs that could connect the experiences of both groups who've shaped and occupied these neighborhoods. Castroville's Historic Japanese School, I think, is a great example of this kind of approach. It's now being preserved as the proud centerpiece for a new park in a city that is almost 90% Latino. The school was erected by the local Japanese American community in 1935 and bustled with activity before World War II. In 1946, it served as a hostel for returning Nikkei. Sometime in the post-war years, the building was acquired by the Castroville School District and served as its wood shop, and its connection to local Japanese American heritage was lost to public memory. Until about 10 years ago, when the local JACL chapters and the county began an effort that resulted in plans for this new park, which is called Japanese School Park, and the historic school to be renovated into a youth center. They've chosen as their motto, Kodomo no tame ni, para el bien de los niños and for the sake of the children, which I think is a really wonderful way of weaving together what's common in this history, the goal that's driven generations of immigrant parents to build a new life for themselves and their families. As we've conducted this ambitious survey, we've worked to develop awareness and advocacy for historic resources in places where Japanese American historic sites still exist but haven't been identified or valued. We've found that press and community groups and individuals really have a passionate interest for this when that becomes aware to them. I'm just showing you one example. We're in the process of working with Berkeley Architectural Heritage Association and a wonderful volunteer historian, Annie Sue, to nominate the studio of famed artist Chiura Obata and his wife, Ikebana artist Haruko, for local landmark status. The awareness we've raised in Berkeley led the City Council to recognize our project and the legacy of Berkeley's Nikkei community in a proclamation ceremony recently. And city staff has gone on record now as saying that they will refer to our historic resource survey when they review all demolition permits, which is just the kind of trigger that we hope this research will pull. We've been able to elicit an amazing cadre of volunteers for our surveys in the LA and Sacramento area. Organizations representing JA communities and preservation constituencies helped us reach people in both areas. Jill and I would then organize training sessions, and these wonderful people documented what remains in a variety of historic Japan towns. I'm so happy to see Bob Uyayama here, who surveyed the really fascinating town of Florin, a small community outside Sacramento, for this project. In addition to enabling Preserving California's Japantowns to reach our ambitious goal, involving volunteers has been an important way to build knowledge of and stewardship for historic resources. These community connections have begun to inspire spin-off efforts, such as walking tours and community exhibits. In one community, Lodi, we found a remarkably intact two-block section of what had been the historic Japantown and have been working with a group of volunteers to organize a regional preservation workshop with staff from the Office of Historic Preservation and the local museum in hopes of laying the groundwork for protection of this district, because the city is now contemplating a redevelopment area encompassing these blocks. Although it wasn't in our original grant goals, we found an opportunity to create a website, which you see here, www.californiajapantowns.org, which has proved to be a really useful tool for sharing our project, along with interactive maps of San Francisco, San Jose, and Los Angeles, Nihonmachi. The site includes an overview of Preserving California's Japantowns, profiles of some of the communities we've studied, a resource page with an extensive bibliography, and links to preservation and Nikkei organizations. Recent funding from CCLEP has allowed us to conduct place-based interviews with Nisei, and we've added a prototype, an interview that Jill and I did with 92-year-old Leo Saito about Oakland's Japantown just recently. We're in the last phases of putting on a preservation toolkit that will give people resources and guidance if they want to document and do preservation programs in their own Nihonmachi. And we're looking for funding to totally complete the website, put all of our data up and additional interviews, and find a long-term host so that this can be a resource for planners, community groups, preservation advocacy organizations for at least a decade. Because people are eager for this information, and sharing the information we've gathered is going to support local governments and heritage organizations to more fully understand their community history, but also to make better decisions as they consider options about development and stewardship of their community. I'm just going to close with a few thoughts about moving this from the foundation of identifying sites to fostering stewardship through interpretation and preservation. This is an important moment, as was clear from Mr. Uno's presentation. Development pressures, not just in California, but everywhere, threaten many resources that are mostly unknown to local advocates and decision makers. Yet our surveys show that we can reclaim space for a richer understanding of Nikkei experience and the importance of Japanese American history to our state and nation. and local communities have demonstrated their eagerness to work with this information. In fact, what's been striking about this project is how multifaceted are the potential approaches to using and analyzing the materials we've gathered. These surveys provide a window into the distinct aspects of Japanese American heritage, especially the uniquely devastating rupture of World War II. But they've also identified sites, many sites, with rich associations to other communities, whether it's through succession of use or a particular structure, or commonalities of experience among American immigrants. I hope that some of you will visit our website, be in communication with us if you know of places in California or even outside California that you think should be included in our work, and that I get a chance to talk with you later. Thank you for your time.
Presenters. There is the luncheon beginning in about 5 minutes over in the ballroom, but I do encourage you to go look at the website for Preserving California Japan Towns. It's an amazing, amazing resource. You could spend hours there. There's so much information. But please pick up information at the back table with Jill. And again, please, now that you recognize each other, please do continue to talk to each other over the course of the rest of the conference. So thank you for coming.